Marker, camera, roll 8, sound roll 4, take 1.
Got it. Okay, this is an interview with Mike Ybarra. Mike, let's start by telling me how you first heard about this guy that you spend most of your life working for here.
Caesar.
Yeah.
Oh, that was quite a moment for me. I was reading a magazine, and a magazine, this man was going to organize the farm workers. And I laughed, and passed the page. Well, what went through my mind was so many people had tried, the Teamsters and the farm workers and other people, this is going to do it. I didn't believe him. But then as time went by, and I heard him going to the pilgrimage to Sacramento. And I said, well, this guy is doing something. He wants to do something. He will do something. So I was kind of a foreman at work. So I told the workers, all he's asking is to boycott the grapes. Why don't we help him? That's for money or nothing. So everybody agreed that we're going to boycott, not take grapes to work. The wives were the problem. They used to forget and put in a lunch. Then I had to go talk to the wives. No more grapes. That's how we started. Then my kids got involved, my family. And then Richard Ybarra put one of my oldest sons, he put security on Caesar. And we talked about different ways of securing him to keep him out of harm's way. But before then, he invited me to come to La Paz to check security here, see how it was. You forget about it, you can't get it. You got the highway, the train, the railroad. Impossible. But outdoors, when you leave town, that's where you want to do it. Because I have seen so many people read about and study who were assassinated. And it was always out somewhere in the road. So I told them about the diamond formation that they use in the infantry, point, sight, and rear. Only this time we're going to be closed in, not extended. So we use that one to this day. And each man had a role to play. And we used that. I thought it was very effective. We knew that because of us being there, we kept him well.
Now, why was Caesar's security such an important issue?
Threats on him constantly. FBI would send letters. Other industries. Who they were, Teamsters coming in. I was worried about the mafia moving in and blowing us all out of the way. I didn't want to tell the guards that, but I didn't think we had a chance. But I always hoped that we could get him out. I knew we could. So we could do something to get him out, just a split second to get him out. Even some of us may go. You know, to this day, I meet the guards, ex-guards come to talk to me. And they say, Mike, he said, people don't know why we were going to give our lives for him. They didn't know that how much we loved him. And I tell the guys, well, listen, remember this. We took care of him. We all did our job, took care of him, got them out of harm's way. We never lost him. He was taken away. I never did think of God. Never thought of that part of it. That was it.
When you were talking about getting interested in the movement early on, you said there was something about the first march, the Peregrinación, that struck you. Was the fact that it was religious, did that convince you? Or what was it that made you think that this guy was for real?
No, I never thought of religion. It didn't enter my mind that he was doing it for the people. He wasn't a celebrity or somebody running for office who would spend so much money to get that position for his own power. He was doing it for the people. And that I saw that he was different. Then when I heard him talk, and then I could see that he was a okay guy, that he wasn't. Then I heard that he didn't like ties. Hey, right up my alley. I don't have to get dressed up. And all the different factors that made him such a... You know, one time I saw him at a synagogue talking to a... It was packed. And they had priests and ministers and everything you could think of up on stage. And after it was over and they left, the people left, they went to a meeting. And I stayed in the rear seat while the guys were outside in the cars, resting, all the other guards. And when I saw them coming down the aisle, I went and alerted them, here they come. So then Caesar was walking with them, and there was a man working on the aisles, picking up the seats and cleaning up. And all the crowd of priests and ministers, he's the only guy that walked down the aisle, went and thanked that worker. It was late at night. I thought that was a great move on his part.
That says a lot about him.
Yeah.
You ended up spending quite a lot of time with him, and I know one of the things you guys had in common was you were in the Marines and he was in the Navy, and you shared a lot of...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had that in common, that we had been in the service. But the one thing that we had more in common, that we knew all the history had gone on, being almost the same age, so we could talk about any topic, and we knew what we were talking about. It was before my time, not it was our time. And old movies. He knew all the actors and he knew so much. Baseball players, boxers. He knew everything that was going on the records. You had to be on your toes with this guy. He knew. You couldn't bluff him. Music. Love music. All kinds of music. Any kind. Mexican, American, what have you. He loved the music. And be in a car, and he wanted to sing. And then we had a role we used to play. If someone was behind in the back seat, he would, I knew he was going to start. I'm driving. Play it, Sam. I said, no, come on, boss. I don't know it. I don't remember. I would play that role. Come on. You sang it for me. You sang it for me. So we were going to singing songs, all the old Glenn Miller songs. Chattanooga Choo Choo, one of our favorites. And we went out.
What was the song you said it was his favorite song for driving? Tell me.
I Can't Get Started With You. And that was Benny Goodman's favorite also. I Can't Get Started With You by Bunny Berrigan, playing the trumpet for Benny Goodman. But the one he liked to sing, Billie Holiday, her singing it, really moved it. Billie Holiday and all the other people that were singing that song, no matter who sang it. But he had one of the favorite songs, which is his song and Helen's, was, what is it? I can't think of the song. His theme song, Stardust. And sing Stardust. So as I was singing Stardust, he'd be dancing. I mean, so I went to see. And I wanted to stop. And he was still dancing, so I had to keep going. Repeat the words. I didn't know the words, to make up words. Because he was dancing with his eyes shut. I guess he was reminiscent. But he loved music.
You were telling me Can't Get Started With You, you played over and over again so you wouldn't fall asleep at night.
Oh, okay, yeah, coming home, long rides. Yeah, I knew he was going to go to sleep whenever he put those songs on there. And he'd be playing it. I'm going home with Billie Holiday. Or Edie Gourmet and Tio Los Panchos. He loved that one also, because they were Mexican ballads, the whole thing. And over again, every time he get here to La Paz, I'd wake him up. Cesar, you home? Oh, La Paz. He'd be very happy. And they get people's house, and that was it. 4 or 5 in the morning. He never said, go get some rest. He said, brother, I'll see you at 8. I said, yes, sir. I was there at 8.
People would see Cesar in public and they'd see him make speeches and they'd see him on the picket line, but he spent a lot of time with him alone, just, you know, when he was tired out, when he was beat. What was he like when he was just alone by himself as opposed to when he was giving a speech?
Like I said, after when I see him, when leave La Paz, going somewhere, and he would be tight from all the things he had to answer and the meetings he had right here in La Paz. Oh, he lay back in the car and exhausted. And then I start talking about different anything away from the union work, that news or whatever. Football. Once I
stop right here. We have to change from that.
Camera roll 9, sound roll 4, take 2.
Got it. Let's talk a little bit more about music. You were telling me about you'd always look for record stores for him. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, yeah. When he, the big bands, of course, when him and I were in on that, and he had danced to many of them, as I had. And he mentioned Catalina Island at the Avalon, that he got there to hear bands there in L.A., and I heard the ones in San Diego, of course. So then we went into jazz, and that was different. It was better than just the big bands. And, well, of course, we had no money to buy all these, you know, they cost a little more. They were a little expensive. So I told them, let's use our lunch money. You know, you fast, I'll fast with you. And then most of the time, people don't invite you to eat anywhere, so I don't have to eat. I'm going to get the soda now. I'm a soda man. I got to get a soda pop. So we started doing that. And wherever we went, while he was meeting, talking to the people he had to meet with, I go to the Yellow Pages, any city, any state, Canada, and we find jazz, little store somewhere. Down in the basement somewhere, there they were. And we buy the records that we were looking for. But he had a book that he had bought at one of the music stores. They went by stars, you know, 1, 2, 3. So we had to buy a 4-star. Like I told you before, 1-star would have been enough for those great guys, but he had to get a 4-star. And this is the one we bought. And he would make them into a tape. And we traveled, we had our own music. He'd ask me, what do you hear? I'd say anything, as long as it was Billie Holiday. That was my favorite, but he loved them all. Lester Young and Cole Yardbirds and all those Blue Note was the most of the notes record that we bought. And then I bought him a container so you could put the tapes in order in there. And he would check, and he would tape them himself. That was his tapes. He never made two. Tell you what, we were partners. It was great.
The other experience you shared a lot with Caesar was the marches together.
Talk oh, boy. One time he asked me, are you in the marches? Yes, I'm unfortunately just in the military.
Could you start over again, instead of saying he, sometimes we'll just use what you're saying. Say, one time Caesar asked me to go.
Okay. Caesar asked me once, have you been on marches? And I said, yes, many times, unfortunately, in the military. He said, well, we're gonna do some walking, you know. Oh, sure, I'm with you. And the first big march we had was the one he started in San Ysidro. Touched the borderline and took off for Sacramento and then down to La Paz. Almost 59 days, almost 15 and a half days. Over 1,000 miles that man walked, every step of it. I went to come in second, I guess, because I had to drive the car, help do other work. But I lost 30 pounds, felt great. He did too. After a while, we were so tough by that time that we could run daily and walk real fast. When we left, what was it, Merced, and he wanted to get to Fresno for the convention. This is August now. We had started in July the 1st, so now we're about August 10th somewhere in there. And the convention was going to be held in that weekend in Fresno. So he wanted to get there and rest, think, write his speech and all that. So he said, I'm taking the point. Go ahead. So he did. Started walking up real fast. And cameras from different televisions come by, and there were two pictures of our feet. They were just not even touching the ground. We were doing 4 or 5 miles an hour, easy. And then just stretch out and go. Stretch up and go. Then he would run. One time he started running, and there was two guys on each side of him, two was behind him, and then the guy on the right conked out, and this man moved in there. The guy on the left says, Mike, and he moved out. He went out with pains on the side. Now I'm going with him, step by step, and a telephone pole. When we get to the telephone, he's going to stop. Didn't stop. When you get to the sign, he's going to stop. He kept going and going and going. Oh, my God. Finally, he stopped. He looked back behind us. There was no line. Everybody scattered on the ground. People hanging over the hoods of cars, being carried, you know, all kinds of things. But we did it. And we arrived in Fresno Tuesday evening, afternoon, that'd be the afternoon. It was hot. All these days was like the heat was just waiting for us to eat us up alive. Hot. So we were there in plenty of time for him to write his speech and rest. And many times we stayed at a house, he'd be carried, not just to march, but every night he had to go speak somewhere. We had to get in the cars, and he already had an advanced team. We go to some anywhere that we had already set up, and he'd talk about the, what he was announcing was the being the ALRB. It's gonna start in September. It started in August. So that's what he was announcing. So every night, somewhere. Sometime when I stay in the house where he was in, there's 8 of us with him, so we had sometimes we didn't fit in one house. And they put him in, take him to his room, somebody they get him rubbed down. I said, poor guy, tomorrow he's not gonna be able to make it. Next morning, I comes out of the bedroom, and he would act funny at times. So he would crank himself, just point me where I have to go. Like a little toy. Off you go. Tough guy. One of the tough guys.
Oh,
really, really, really. He said he felt great. I think he got one small blister, and he was angry because he had two socks, and he was wearing two socks. I was wearing one sock. We all had our own theories, and one of the folds made him a blister.
One of the reasons he stayed so healthy was because how he took care of himself and ate certain foods. Talk a little bit about.
Oh boy, that his eating habits.
Talk about again. Say Caesar's eating. Yeah,
Caesar's. Eating habits were something else, because everything had to be just clean and perfect. No, like he would say, pesticides. Why have any tolerance in the food? Why should we not have clean food in the food? And that was his body. It took all everything that had to be the best, the good stuff. And he was a vegetarian for many years, from what I hear. Before I met him, he was already a vegetarian. And then in Detroit, some nuns were invited over to the house, and Caesar was having some kind of soup they made, which to me was blah, and that was macrobiotic. And the sister came over and telling him she had the books, and he was looking at her and then listening, and like that was the best meal I ever had. You know, it make you feel that way. Oh, this fantastic onion soup or whatever it was. He would make a big out of it. And I looked at his eyes, and we're going macro. And we did. Caesar went to Boston, and he met with a guy that had this book, Michio Kushio, the author. And Caesar spent about 2 hours with him there, talking about the macro and other things. And the guy would have talked longer, only he was going to Japan at the time. And the man said how long it was for cancer, to cure cancer. If it was already terminal, I would help the person ease out without less pain. And we're also going into the AIDS, that might help them too. He said also said that the people in Japan, when they dropped the bombs or the A-bombs, people that were on this macrobiotic survived. So Caesar was happy that he was doing this. And he wanted everybody in La Paz to do it. When he opened the kitchen, I had a book in Spanish he gave to the cooks. Everybody was going macro. He wanted everybody. And that nun came over here and spoke here one time. She spoke here to all the people were there. And she was talking about how bad meat is for you and all the things that he was against.
Let me jump in for a second. One of the other things sort of related to the whole issue of health, you were telling me that story yesterday about one day on the march where you got up and your feet were just killing you. You couldn't walk. Tell me that story.
Yeah, he had this knack.
Caesar
had this knack that he could cure people. Aches, headaches were a snap for him. You could put your arms behind your head, behind your head. He get behind you, and after you finished that, your headache was gone. Backs, anything that he could do. The puncture stuff that he would. So he come by one time. Caesar, this girl had the headache. Press right here, and she did. And my headache's gone. So he did those things, and I thought, could it be true or not? I didn't know. And we were watching the state. We marched. Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, Washington State, Pittsburgh, so many places that I walked. And even though he had all the things in his mind, not behind him, everywhere he went, and Caesar would turn around, he always asked me, how you doing, brother? I'm okay. If I was afraid, I wouldn't be there, maybe.
Well, one day you weren't okay, right?
Oh, yes, one day in Washington, my feet were flat and I couldn't move. How am I going to carry the suitcases and drive the car and everything else? This way. When we got to this house, the lady saw me walking, limping. Did your feet hurt? I said, yes, ma'am. I'll get you an aspirin. And Caesar was walking into the living room, and he had his hand in his pocket. He started running to the back. Your feet hurt? Yes, sir. Take out your shoes, and I'll fix you right now. Oh. So I took out my tennis shoes, and he pressed my toes for about 10, 15 minutes. And what do you feel? What do you feel? Then I felt a heat from my feet, hot heat, moving up my legs, and the pain was gone. And I couldn't stop my feet. And prior to that, wherever I was sitting, sometimes in the bottom of my feet, I could hear nine from pain. I get some too much walk. After that, I never felt that pain again. But one of the most fantastic things Caesar ever did, on the same day in Washington, we're waiting for the march to line up, people to get started to go. Early in the morning, sun hasn't come up yet, just breaking daylight. And this one lady came out of a car, and the man told her to get out quick because I was staring at this man and he was faced the wrong way. Not that he might get hit and apply to the people. So the guy was, you knew he was wrong. So she was in a hurry, and when she went to slam the door, I knew she was going to get her hand caught, which she did. Ah, and she yelled. And Caesar right away walked up to her, and I walked next to him, and he grabbed her hole and rubbed her hand, and the pain was gone. And she was saying, what you do to me? What you do to me? The pain's gone. What happened? And in Spanish, of course, it was all in Spanish. And I'm staring at the man. And I said, Caesar.
Marker, take 3, camera roll 10, sound roll 5.
Mike, I've been trying to tell you, don't say he, say Caesar. And you told me there's a reason why you're used to saying he. What's the reason?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was so used to never using his name. We never use his name on a phone or anything. And
I'm so used to not seeing Caesar.
I'm not used to saying his name Caesar, because we didn't want anybody to know that he was around. Caesar was around. So we all became used to saying he, Dorothy was the chief, never Caesar. So it was hard for me to break that rule, that, you know. So that's why I kept saying, you kept correcting me to say the name of Caesar. I would gladly say Caesar, but it just, yeah.
Tell me about some of the times in security. Were there any times when you really were worried, when there was a real problem? Can you tell me, remember anything like that?
Yeah, there was several occasions that things weren't right on the road.
I remember I was struck. I was rolling.
Take 4, camera roll 10, sound roll 5.
So, Mike, we're talking about security, and tell me what the difference is between the way you guys would operate and the way someone like the Secret Service would operate.
Well, it was simple, very easy for us. We all were close to Caesar. I told you about that diamond formation. So there was always a point in the side and the one in the rear. The guy in the rear was supposed to pull him out. In the split second when the noise went on to get him out. And when the Secret Service were helping their people, candidates, governors, whoever they were taking care of.
Gunshots.
Gunshots.
Now, take cover. Let's cut for a second.
I don't really hear anything.
You know? Are we still on?
Still rolling.
Okay.
Still rolling.
Okay, so go ahead.
Yeah, so they would be a disciplined man. Their principal.
Start over again. Say the Secret Service.
The Secret Service were averted from their principal. A distance, 20, 30 feet. When he was going to the crowds, they wouldn't go with the principal. And I told Caesar one time, Caesar, see the way those people take care of their principal? They're a distance away from him? And our guys right next to you get mad, you turn around, you bump into us. He says, yeah, why is that? So it's very simple, Caesar. If they lose their principal, tomorrow they have another guy. We lose you. We don't have no more. Oh, he finally understood. He never could understand why I was right next to him, riding him.
There was also something else about that too, which is for the Secret Service, it was just a job. For you, it was something else, wasn't it?
Oh, sure. No, all of us would ask. You know, would you do this for Caesar? For Caesar, sure, I would give my life. Everybody felt that way. Weapons. Would you accept if I gave you a gun someday? Would you use it? We're not violent. We were walking down the street here. I said, I know we're not violent, but we had to secure Caesar. Oh, for him, sure. You know, he probably wouldn't know how to use one, but he said he would use one. You know.
So was there ever a moment when that was really tested? When you thought someone was
going to
get it?
We felt that every day we went somewhere, that was the time. I always role play wherever we were. This could be the spot, and we were ready for it. I was ready for it. I don't know what the other guys were doing, but I had my compadre, Leonard, I told him, he always had the point, Frank Curiel. And I said, Frank, I was figuring I was going to lose you. Why me? Because you're always in front of you. He said, I'll get excited right away. So I was going to go with you. I wasn't going to let you go by yourself. But we were in Pittsburgh one time. And we got a call from Mark Grossman, you know him and Mark. He read me a letter that the Times newspaper had from L.A. And the letter was content was that we had to get rid of this man before the month is up. He's just a thorn in our side. Okay, what we use, grenades, whatever it takes to get him out of our way. And if he were reading me the letter, I was taking down notes. And looking over the calendar, it was almost the last day of the month. Oh, my God. So, okay, Mark, you got it all down, Mike? I'll call him right now, Mark. Okay. So, I didn't call him, by the way. I started calling the airports to get him out of Pittsburgh. Only place we go was Chicago and stand over again. So, there was no way to get out that night to L.A. Until tomorrow morning. So, I made passage for tomorrow morning. Then I went and woke him up. Caesar? Yeah. Time to get up? No, he said, then I told him, we just got a letter from Mark Grossman where they want to kill you. He jumped out of bed. Boom! Hit the floor, walking back and forth, angry. We're beating them. That's why they're doing this. We're beating them. And walking back and forth. Caesar, do you want to go on with the trip? Do you want to go home? We're going home. Okay, I'll go call the sister, a nun who was in charge of the house. Yeah, bring her over here. I'll tell her. Okay. So I went and called her. She wanted to talk to her. And she came in. She told me she started shaking. She couldn't start shaking. I had to hold her, sit her down. She became so nervous. So we'll go on with tonight's events. But tomorrow morning, he won't be here. We left, came to LA. And I had called La Paz and told the guys I was coming into town and I wanted to see them again. I hadn't been by for so long, but I wanted everybody there, everyone. And the guy said, okay, we'll be there. So they had, half of La Paz was up there. Cars all over the place, were different cars going different ways. So they didn't know which one car Caesar was in. And as we were coming out of the airport, like a hidden nudging Caesar. Our guys were all winding up like in a movie, reading the magazine letters, going up all the way up to the out of the airport. And we came home. Came home, and we never know how the threat went, but that happened that time there. And like I said, we all thought to the guys, somebody didn't try it, because we were there. We were by his side. And that was it, on security. But sometimes I just to try myself, you know, maybe he wouldn't be there, but I would have something to happen.
Did he accept that the security was necessary, or did it always bother
him? It always bothered him. He didn't want guards with him. Well, towards the end, after 78, 79, there was no more guards, no more 2-3 cars, one car, him and I in the car.
Let's go back a little bit to shopping for records.
Sure.
For old records and stores.
Yeah.
Like in New York, when you were in New York, would you find record stores there?
Oh, anywhere you go, it's amazing. There's always a little jazz store somewhere. And some little corner, you wouldn't think about it. You go down there, there's a little store, and they have jazz records everywhere. So it was New York, of course, would have had them, and other places. But it was just fun. It was fun being with him, you know. I was never home. My wife's still jealous. You want to be with him, but you want to be with us. It was so much fun. So, you know, so exciting. So many interesting things that would happen. People he would meet, and I would get to meet them.
Well, you know, you describe it like it was all good times, but there were some hard times too, weren't there?
There were long days for him, you know.
When things weren't going well, when there was a lot of
pressure. A lot of pressure on him. He was always under pressure. That guy lived under pressure. And he worked every day. He never had that weekend or that long holiday. He was working. He was always doing something. I couldn't get off on the vacation if I wanted to. I didn't want to anyhow. I wanted to be sure that I was with him. I always felt that I would regret had I gone somewhere and something would have happened. I wouldn't have been there where I could have done something. And I guess other people felt the same way. His brother Manuel felt that he was the one that could do it. We all felt that, each one of us felt that we were the guy that could pull it off.
But when he was under pressure, was he harder to be around?
He was tough. We got bawling outs, you know. And we knew when he was angry, anything that happened, I knew that the pressure was on him. And I wouldn't. Many times we had discussions, arguments, you know. But I knew that I was wrong in arguing with him. But I wanted him to come out with some more to get it out of his system. So.
The last thing is talk a little bit about, you said you didn't actually travel with him to Arizona. Talk about what that meant to you when he died and what.
Sure.
Left.
Yeah, when he came to the house before you're going to leave to Arizona, and he was eating, my wife makes some raw hot salsa, and he had some Fritos and eating that. Nobody, I don't want to eat. But she was making supper for him. And we were talking at the table, and he looked beat. He looked tired. I never seen him look so tired that night. And then Maria gave the macro, whatever she made. So he ate, and he was full. He was angry because he got so full, he couldn't move. And he told Maria, and she said in Spanish, "One of these days I'm going to take Mike with me." And she said, "Take him." She said, "That's what he wants to be. He wants to be with you. He wants to travel with you." And yes, Caesar, I'm ready to go. I'm well. Come on, take me with you. I want to go. So those were the last words that we had at my house. When we came out of the house, he said, "I drove somewhere." Caesar said, "I drove somewhere, and people." Some family says hello to you. Who was the family? I can't remember. Great. We laughed about that. Then he said, Caesar said, they couldn't understand. Well, where's Mike? Oh, he's homesick. He said, well, what are you driving by yourself? They couldn't understand why. He said, why I was driving by myself. And I said, you know what, Caesar? I can't understand that either, when you're driving by yourself. He turned around and took off walking fast, the way he always did. He never fudged. And I started laughing at him, and he left. I never saw him again, alive. I called Paul, his son, and told him I wanted to go to Yuma. He said, but the gang's there. He meant the gang, he meant the board with him. Oh, I said, they can't take care of him. I'm going to be there. And I told my wife, I'm going to leave this weekend and stay with him, do whatever time it takes. Only the weekend never came. And I was I kept thinking, what a loss. Why him? He took care of himself so well. And you know, when you talked about dying, a way to go. And he said that, I told him, when you're being operated on, put you to sleep, gone. He said, in your sleep. He mentioned in your sleep that would be a good way of going. Yeah, but you never wake up. You're dreaming all the time.
Marker takes 6, camera roll 11, sound roll 5.
So, I guess that's the toughest question of all. Maybe it's not hard at all, but Caesar's gone. What did he mean to you, and what is his legacy? What did he do for farm workers and people in this country?
Changed their life completely. Before, when they were migrant, they all migrant at one time. Migrant, moving, traveling. When you big contracts, and they had all the benefits to come to them. He said the most important one, he would tell me, Cedar would say, security. Not had job security. Now you go to the bank and get a house and stay put in one place, roots. That's what he did to the people. And some of the workers that were at the time started.
Marker takes 7, camera roll 11, sound roll 5.
So Mike, you were telling me what Caesar meant for the farm workers in terms of security. Tell me, in terms of your own life, this is someone you loved, you would have died for him. He meant a lot to you. What have you, talk about what you feel about Caesar.
I guess one of the moments that Caesar that I love to see him do, and he thought he was going to live to be 100 because his mother and father did. But if we traveled to San Jose, and we're going somewhere, if we were to stay, we stayed at his mother's house. If we just passing by, you want to stop by? Do you have time? Oh, we have time. So we stop by mother's house, he'd go in there, meet his mother, and, son, are you staying? She would say, no, just passing by. He would kneel down, and she would give him the benediction. I used to feel warm. Just between that little act, it's still very touching. And after his mother died, I don't think he felt secure himself, you know, that knowing that, because his father died first, then his mother, and it's one of the things that I would think about, Caesar, being so humane and for everybody else. People asked him one time, what if you offer $200,000, $300,000, your famous mammoth, Chavez, what would you do? Would you accept? Oh, no, I wouldn't accept, he said. But I would ask to donate to the union. That was, he never had a words that he would he never, nothing for himself, for everybody else. That's the thing that that all of us loved about him, I guess. That he didn't go out to make that $1 million the American way. He just went on a volunteer and what he lived on, $3,000 a year, whatever he got. All the things are the one that I think about. When he died and we came to Bakersfield, I stayed with him from the day he landed here. I was with him at the mortuary for a week. We came here for viewing 2 days. We went back and I helped dress him. I was there when they disrobed him, right from Yuma, and I looked for punctures or something. They might have killed him, and people were saying that he was killed. I told him, no, he wasn't, you know. And I said, well, people that were with him, well, I don't know, they killed themselves, they killed him, the guys that were with him there. So after the time he came to bury him here, I was with him. It took a week. We didn't know how long it was going to be because we couldn't find a place for him. So we came here, and after the march was over, we came here. Then we had to leave back to the mortuary. And I told Caesar, I told him, even now you're still controversy. We can't find a place to bury you. I looked back and talked back to the hearse. We were leaving La Paz. And we brought him here and buried him. When my Paul called my turn to go and throw my shovelful into the grave. Not thinking, I just threw one in there. I was tired. My mind wasn't there. I should have thrown some more in there, but I wish I could now. I regret that. I just went one shovelful, and the family was there, and the board members and all that stuff. So, whenever he wanted, he left me some work. You know, tell me to go somewhere. See, they go over there, pick a call Rick, call this person, and I tell him, see behind that, busca el real chicharrón. And I was looking in a hurry, come back, he would be by himself. So when he was there, my general was there. So I went into a salute and gave a military salute. And I had one of these caps that I just got from New York, and I threw it in the grave so that I could stay with him. And that was it. Yeah. But what a loss. Not only when he was alive, that he could have done so much, and having to fight every day the government and the Republicans and the Teamsters, never let it go what he could do. They were afraid of him, jealousy, I don't know. There was something that they all feared him. And he didn't want anything for himself. When Reagan took over, he said, grab onto your hats, here we go. Again, we're under Republican. When Nixon wanted to get the people together, and you talked about the fast in Arizona. Remember Nixon at the time? I'm saying Nixon should have been here. This man got us all together. He did it. He did it by himself. Just by a little fast.